Welcome to Conflict Managed. I'm your host, Mary Brown. This week, we are joined by Russell Harvey, who is a resilience coach, facilitator, and public speaker. His purpose is to positively affect 100,000 people by the year 2025, and right now, he's over 44,000. This could be by developing a client's self-confidence, providing clarity and direction to their role, providing them with the tools and techniques to create the right conditions to apply transformation to their department or company, and much more. He has a 20-year career in learning, leadership, and organizational development. His overall style is influenced by positive psychology and strengths-based approach. When working with clients, he aims to strike the right balance between pragmatism, creativity, and playfulness, and support, challenge, and progress. In addition to the work with his clients, Russell is the chair of governors of a local primary school and a volunteer with Leeds Young Authors. He also runs public speaking and confidence workshops in schools. Good morning, Russell, and welcome to Conflict Managed.
Hi, Mary. Very nice to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Yes, and I know my listeners can't see this, but in your background, you've got the resilience coach, and I love thinking about and talking about resilience, so I know we're going to have a wonderful conversation today.
Most definitely, yes. It's like the magic of branding, essentially. Yes. The resilience coach is right there, essentially.
That's right. Well, let's start, and will you tell us about the first job you ever had as a young man?
The very first job, I suppose it's babysitting would be the very, very first job that I ever had with some neighbours of mine. And then I was just trying to think whether that was the first one or if it was a paper round. So any paper round babysitting, I think those were the first jobs that I had. Yeah, the paper round sticks in my head because I started with the Sunday newspapers. And I don't know if it's the same in the States, but the Sunday newspapers are just, they are massively thick. There's hundreds of different sections to them and magazines. And it was in quite a nice leafy suburb of where I was born and brought up. So there was a lot, there was long walks up to each driveway. That sticks in my head. So either that or the babysitting.
You know, I've talked to quite a few people and newspaper, you know, boy or girl, is a top first starter job that I hear about. And I think that's interesting because there's so much involved, at least in the paper route in the U.S. There's a while ago, there was collecting money and a variety of initiatives that a person would have to undergo in order to have a successful paper route.
And it is interesting, actually, just because from films, for the whole of the UK, then I, one person in the UK, I just remember the volume of times you see someone in a bicycle literally just throwing a newspaper onto the lawn and then the sprinkler system coming. That's the only memory I have about what paper rounds must be like in the States. Yeah. People listening now might be going, that's not at all, Russell.
That's so funny. From those first jobs, is anything that sticks out to you that you surprised you as being a worker entering the workforce? You know, babysitting and paper routing is pretty low, you know, isolating jobs. You're not working with a team.
Yeah. So I suppose the connection. So it's this word responsibility, I think, mm-hmm. is like where you get to understand that initially. You know, stating the obvious of like with the paper round, you know, it's the Sunday morning, so you have to get up early. And to make sure that you do it, you know, get yourself up, set an alarm. Couldn't rely on my parents to wake me up to do it. So I'm pretty sure I did that by myself. And I suppose you want to do good customer service. So, you know, it's visualizing the fact that these people are waiting for their papers and they're in a leisurely way, you know, probably haven't got dressed. They want to just get in their dressing gown, a cup of tea or coffee, and it's all nice and neat for them. So if it's ever ripped or torn, you get worried about that, essentially. And yeah, the babysitting one, definitely responsible. Yes, you've got two young people neighbours, two young boys. Most definitely, just hoping nothing would go wrong. Yeah, so you definitely felt the weight of responsibility and sort of relieved when it was simple and quiet and nothing happened.
Love that responsibility. A lot of times those first jobs, we don't, you know, since we haven't been in the world of work or anything like that, we've just been living our lives, you know, and what we encounter. And both of those jobs are heavy responsibility because they're on you. And we don't think about it so much when we're young, but we think, well, we want to do a good job. We want to be asked back. We want to get paid. And that sort of internalization of what needs to happen. And of course, being responsible carries throughout our whole life. And, you know, insofar as we want to be successful and have happy relationships, you know, it behooves us to learn and cherish being responsible.
Well, I'm just thinking about it, actually, as you're talking then, I'm wondering if first job was before them. So when I did get pocket money, that was actually because I did jobs around the house, you know, both my sister and I did it. So it was like you absolutely knew that you weren't just getting pocket money for the sake of it. It's the fact that there were jobs and tasks that you needed to do to actually warrant getting your whatever it was. Can't remember what it was. At the end of each week, it wasn't just given to you for the sake of it. It's like you had things that you needed to do. It was a transaction, I suppose. Mm-hmm. It taught values from an early age.
Yes. So where did you go from those early jobs? What did you end up doing in college?
So college was, there was sixth form and college and university. So college, I worked at a chemist's. Because I did work experience there, and that work experience actually went into a job. So Boots the Chemist, I think very similar to Walgreens, trying to think of people listening, some similarity for them, which I loved. And then that went on to a DIY store. The DIY store was like pallets of tiles. So, you know, house tiles, bathroom tiles. The deliveries of tiles and hours and hours of time lifting boxes of and kitchen worktops, these like 6, 9 foot, 11 foot heavy worktops, and having to heave those into places. So the big memory of that one is like heavy lifting, essentially, as well as customer service. And then when I went to university, just before I went, I actually got a job in a pub, which was fabulous, which is really good. And very nicely, I was quite unique. So the first few years at university, I didn't go into sort of financial debt. I didn't go overdrawn, because literally every holiday I would go home, and then all these shifts in the pub I would have, and they helped me. And I remember the very first time, after a number of years being in university, going into the bank manager at the local university branch, because I did need a bit of an overdraft. I love like a few hundred pounds. And I remember the conversation the bank manager, he sort of asked us a few questions about who I was and what I was doing. And then he just sort of says, I've been looking at your record. You've been at university for 3 years and you've never come to see me. And your account's been healthy all this time. You tell me the reason why you want a few hundred quid. It was just like, you're very unique. You can have whatever you want.
Wow. Isn't that so? That is so interesting that we are constantly forming our reputation many times unbeknownst to us, right? So,
true.
Insofar as we show up and we're responsible and we have a good work ethic, then people see. So, we don't just do it for the people around us or for ourselves, but we are building who we are. And we never know those relationships or somebody on the outside seeing, like this bank. That's so interesting. That's a good reminder of, you know, keeping your side of the street clean, of showing up for yourself and doing good work, and the benefit of that. The benefit, even though you don't know at the time you're going to get it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You're spreading sort of ripples of who you are all the time out into the universe. Yeah,
absolutely. Like, what did you major in at university?
So I started out doing a diploma in business and finance, and then that morphed into an economics and politics degree. And then over time, I dropped the economics and finished predominantly doing more of the politics. So business, finance, economics, politics. My relationship with economics is interesting to me, because I absolutely got it when people would give you a sentence of words explaining actually some elements to do with economics. So I go, oh, I get that. Yeah, totally makes sense. Then they give you like some maths or an equation to help explain the words, and I get a little bit lost. And then they give me a graph to explain, and I'm just like, I'm lost. So I struggled with, so I did an economics A level, which is just in between sort of going to university and at night school, and I didn't get it. And then I still was always saying, I understand economics, you know, but eventually doing it as a degree, I absolutely came a cropper and just had to give it up because I just didn't get the math side of things. And it was many, many years later, something that really made me smile. So my wife and I, before we were married, went traveling around the world for a year, and I was teaching in Hong Kong in a college. And I was happened to be teaching economics and all sorts of other subjects, blessed to people that are due to pass an exam. And I remember I was looking at the whiteboard, and I suddenly got something. I suddenly, something that had always eluded me in economics, I suddenly got it whilst I was looking at the whiteboard. And I would turn around excitedly to all of these people that were I was teaching about to be enthusiastic about it, and just their faces were exactly like mine had been for the last 20 years up to that point of like, haven't got a clue. And I was just like, oh God, how do I find a way? How do I find a way to just explain and articulate what I have finally taken me, God knows how long, to understand? I've suddenly got it. I'm excited. And all their faces were just doom and gloom of what is this? What is this stuff? I've no idea whether I achieved that or not. You know?
That is so wonderful. I mean, we are lifelong learners, and even the teacher, right? So I taught forever so long, and you know, I'm constantly learning new things and putting things together. And I think, oh my gosh, what was I doing 15 years ago? Or I suppose I was putting different things together, but that light bulb moment, it's so wonderful to make these connections that you didn't see before. And that's the process of our lives, I suppose.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah. Yes, you know, you never stop learning. And for me, I sometimes talk it as like levels of understanding. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like, I get it. And then there's many times, you know, I went to say, oh, no, I really get it now. And then other times you go, no, actually, do you know what? I've really, really got it, you know?
Yes.
Levels of understanding is the best way I can sort of articulate that.
Well, my understanding of economics, I mean, I could do the philosophy of economics. I absolutely can be on the abstract and talk about, you know, people and society and talk about the economics. But once you present that second level of the numbers, forget about it and forget about the, I'm not mathematically inclined.
There's some irony in there about we're talking about learning. And it took me an awfully long time to understand that what I didn't understand about economics. So it was a mistake for me to even try and do it as a degree. But at the time, you know, didn't have that level of self-awareness to go stick with the politics because it's words, essentially. Mm-hmm. But there we go. Hindsight is a wonderful thing.
You know, I think at university, we try to push kids too early into degrees or at the high school level, you know, actually in junior high, you know, they're saying, what do you want to major in? What do you want to be? And it's like,
yeah.
The way we find out, so I taught philosophy for over 20 years, and I found out about philosophy when I went to the university. My first semester, freshman class, I took a philosophy course, and it really was like this aha moment. I had no idea that was a thing that people could do. But if we don't expose individuals, and a lot of students do go to college thinking they want to do one thing, but as they're exposed to a variety of things and life experiences, they see, as you were saying, like where your gifts are and your passions and therefore what you're most suited to.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah. I mean, the secret of life is find a thing that you love doing and find a way to monetize it or get paid for it. I am there now and have been there for a reasonable, good chunk of time around the thing that I love doing. And I do wonder as well, because I remember at an early age, people asking, what do you want to do? And it was a little bit more about, I was always given the comment of like, oh, you're good with people, Russell. So maybe you should do sales or personnel. And both of those two words turned me off. Ironically, I actually did do both of those. And in some senses, you could say I am doing personnel.
Right.
You could say that. But I'm curious, though, about, I wonder if, so people, you know, 15 upwards, if not maybe 12 afterwards, they are exposed to an awful lot more. So maybe actually the variety of options and choices that exist are more obvious to them, or they, you know, you can search on the, you know, on the web for like, you know, jobs, and then it'll come up. So I'm wondering if there's like all of that choice makes it easier for people to go, oh, I think it's that. I've no idea.
Yeah, I'm not sure. You would think because of information is so readily available and it's in the hands of most people. But I still find that a lot of individuals, if you don't already know what your career path is or what it is that you want to do, at least at the first stage of your life, it still seems to be very elusive. What is that for me? What does it really mean for me? Especially as a young person, you don't have a lot to back behind that. Like, what does that actually mean on a 9-to-5? What kind of lifestyle would I have? What would I be doing day to day? And so I think there's lots of opportunities to develop that, to put some more flesh into it. But yeah, I wonder if, I mean, students obviously need guidance in order to find that and to have those put before them, those options.
I think a massive gap in all of that as well is this, is that, you know, the tens of millions of people that actually are line managers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can have all sorts of fancy job titles, but you are also line managers. So if you walk into any schools and colleges and sort of say, oh, stick your hand up who somebody wants to be a line manager for their career, the vast majority of people may not know what that means.
Right.
And also, so yeah, it keeps people like me in a job or in work doing what I love. And I still think there's just an enormous missed opportunity in all of this to help people understand that actually, regardless of the role that they want or the lifestyle that they want, that they are going to be line managers.
Mm.
You know, you are going to be accountable and responsible for somebody else's well-being and driving their passions and playing to their strengths and coaching and, you know, asking more rather than telling. So, yeah, I think it's a massive gap still.
Yeah, I agree. So did you do some work in politics for a while?
No, I didn't. So when I left university, my girlfriend and my wife, Trish, whom I went traveling with, we always knew we were going to go traveling. So it was a case of find a role when you'd finished university, and it happened to be a sales role, you know. It was absolutely fascinating. It was in building products. So I did that for a while and just met some really interesting characters. Then we went traveling for a year where the spark of who I am now came from. So back to teaching in Hong Kong. Not in the college, I did some English language classes from people off the street. And it was whilst I was doing that, that I was just going, this is magical. Something wonderful is happening here. I don't know what it is, but I think I want to do this for a living. And I knew I didn't want to be a teacher in a school. Just that visualization wasn't for me, although I've done lots of works in schools. And my wife is a teacher. And so it turned out later, it was like people learning. People having their light bulb moments, people having realization moments and working stuff out and going from confused face to light bulb face. It was like, that's magical. I want to do that for a living. So came back to the UK and I only knew sales. So I took another sales job. But all at the time, I actually knew that I wanted to be in learning and development. At the time, it was called like training. So mm-hmm. I went to night school, paid for myself to do a, you know, certificate in training. And then slowly shifted away from the sales into various training roles. And then they became learning and development roles, leadership development, coaching and facilitation. So, yeah, the last sort of 20 years of my career has been very much in the learning and leadership and coaching space.
So when you think about all the different jobs that you've had, which are varied and all over the place, what strikes you as the best situation with another colleague or boss? And what was it that was so good about it? What resonated with you?
So to be fair, you know, the role that I'm doing now is, you know, owner MD of the Resilience Coach. That's fabulous because I just get to work with people all the time that I love, clients and colleagues. But I go all the way back to many years ago. I was worked in a utilities company and I had the job role. So officially it was a business change manager or a project manager. But essentially, the head of the function, Laura, famous, absolutely was into sort of like, we need to have a good culture in our business. And so because I had this, I think still this label of like, you're good with the people, Russell, or people seem to enjoy spending time with you. Essentially, I felt like I was head of fun. Because that I was just doing these projects about actually, how can we have fun in the workplace? What can we do? You know, just absolutely putting on big charity events or just games or things like that. that was my job role, but I had to do it as like a project manager. And my lady that I sat next to, Becky Ryder, hello, Becky, still friends with her now, saw her a couple of weeks ago. She was just awesome because I would be sort of spouting in sort of high level language about these are the things that we're going to do. And she had an analyst's mind and would literally be just going, but what about the detail, Russell? It would be like she was just poking and prodding me and just picking at all of my, you know, high level thoughts all of the time. But as a consequence of that, it was brilliant. It worked rather, and it made sure that things happened and happened the way that they should. So that springs to mind right now. And a job title of head of fun, it was just brilliant. And it was supported by Becky, who just used to each day, every day, just sit next to us and make sure that my like highfalutin, high thoughts, you know, out there, big picture thinking, it actually became something real and tangible and doable and achievable.
What a wonderful experience. It's because we do need both. We need the people with the big ideas, and then we need the people who say, okay, well, this is how it can actually be executed. Because if you don't have both of those aspects, then you're not going to have the product. Right. And so clearly it was a good work environment where you were supported. And it sounds like there's a lot of synergy and this environment that was conducive to have you be your brilliant self, because you can't be the head of fun if you're by yourself and nothing's working.
Yeah, most definitely. Most definitely. That was really enjoyable. So because I was doing the learning and development role there as well, because I was doing management training, but I just did a side step for a while for this like business change manager, because somebody, you know, came along and said it's good to have that on your CV as well, that you've done these types of things. And it's really useful. You know, I'm not a natural project manager, and I did like a simple 2-day project management qualification, but it's held me in good stead, you know, for a sort of lifetime. It doesn't mean I'm brilliant at it, but I understand the principles of what I'm supposed to do to deliver something.
That is such a good reason to go ahead and read that book or take that course, because we never know that little nugget that we pick up someplace that we use for the rest of our life, that all of a sudden we're in a situation or a meeting, we're like, oh, I know what they're talking about, or I can contribute because of this thing I did 15 years ago, 5 years ago. And the more we invest in ourselves, and just the taking the little opportunities, they really compound to help us be better at whatever we're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I've managed, so I do a lot of work now around playing to your strengths. So I use a psychometric called strength scope, you know, things that naturally energize you. So one of my significant 7 strengths is strategic mindedness. So big picture, end point, you know, what does the future state of where you want to get to look like, sound like, and feel like? You know, that highly energizes me. And so I'll do that first, and then I can bring in the sort of project management thinking to go, right, how do I backtrack from that point to get me to what it is that I'm supposed to be doing right now? And then ultimately, I also know one of my other strengths is collaboration. So once I've done some of that, I can only get so far with what are all the steps I need to take. I know that then I need to pick up with people that are similar to Becky in my network and go, I've got so far, you've got this type of brain. Can you now add some further things to it that I just can't do? You know, it's not my thing, essentially.
That's right. I think it's interesting. So head of fun and this idea of joy and fun at work. And I also noticed on some of the things that you help your clients do is be pragmatic. And some might think those are diametrically opposed. And yet I see them as working really well together. We have this loneliness epidemic at work. We have people who are disaffected, quiet quitting. And yet they also say, well, why would I need to participate in this quote unquote fun thing? This is not what I'm here for. So can you talk to us about how those things do work together? Collegiality and merriment along with the practical aspects of our jobs?
Yeah, so I suppose it is ultimately, it's within the leader's gift to think about actually what's the genuine culture that we want to create around here. So it is, you know, to that C word. And it is about everybody's roles and responsibilities. really. So it's about the leadership of it, and it's also about the individual. So the individual, if they're wanting to come to the workplace with too much of an attitude and a mindset of, yeah, this is me, these are my strengths, and I literally will just play to my strengths, and I'm not interested. And if that means I'm not really interested in the team stuff, or, you know, working with colleagues, I just want to do things my way, and my expectation is that the organization is just going to let me do that, I don't think that's realistic enough, you know. So in working with some people that sort of say, look, this is me and this is just what I want to do, then it is those reflections with them, you know, ask the right coaching question about actually what's the benefits around that and what's the risks around that. And, you know, you quite often find out that people sort of say, well, actually, I do feel a little bit lonely in the workplace, or not very many people sort of contact me. And it's like, well, behavior breeds behavior in a whole variety of ways. What is it that you have done to, you know, make sure that you are part of the team or part of the organization? You know, how have you dipped your toe in the water? Where have you done things that might have been outside of your comfort zone? You know, if you do that, then you'll get some reciprocity from your colleagues in the organization. And I think it's really, really clear. It has to be really, really clear from the leadership that, you know, they absolutely have to make sure that we play to people's strengths. We think about diversity and inclusion and neurodiversity. Absolutely. And as well, organizations can tie themselves in knots about trying to be all things to all people. So pragmatically, you are going to have to say, look, you know, the leadership is absolutely about this is the type of organization that we want to have. You know, we've got to have some balance to in it. We do want to have those conversations around what do we want people to say about us, customers and colleagues, about what it feels like to work around here? What are those measures that we want? And so sometimes that does mean to say to people, if you want to turn up to this organization and just sort of say, I want to just do my job and be left alone, then you need to have quality conversations with them to go, maybe you're not right for us. Mm-hmm. Don't employ them in the first place. You know, so I think we get into a bit of a pickle around that. And the additional overlay around that is, as a consequence of COVID and the pandemic, far more people, individuals, there's far more people power in a lot of places about actually the organization is going to have to shift far more towards me. Because actually I've understood that there's some employee power and people power. So everybody's wrestling with actually how much of a shift have we got to take, you know? So you've got to be pragmatic of like, we're not all right for each other. And then you do that well, things I've talked about, that's when you will actually give yourself a chance to have a resilient organization and a resilient set of humans, because you are playing to their strengths more and you haven't actually employed somebody between yourselves on like false pretenses of like, this person has clearly stated that interview that they just want to do things this way, you know, and we've gone, yeah, okay, we want you for these skills, we'll allow that, or we've not thought about it. It's like, actually, we need to be better at going, actually, they gave us some clues there to maybe they're not right for us, so we shouldn't have employed them in the first place.
Yeah, we should really listen to what people are actually saying instead of the anxiety of, you know, this job, this hole isn't filled, and so we need somebody. But, you know, patience, listening, and the pre-hire, and clarity is kindness. You know, so if you employ somebody and they have said, you know, I don't want to do X, Y, and Z, I just want to pump out your, you know, news article. And if you're making an exception for that one person, what is that message to that person as they might feel excluded? What is the message to everybody else? So absolutely that clarity from the very beginning of everybody's role, the culture, what is required, and how do we make everyone flourish, help everyone flourish?
And so on that exact point, help everyone flourish. So, you know, interviewers, organizations, it's like people that are listening now, really consider like the interview questions you ask. So there are a whole variety of ways in which you can help yourself discover what people's strengths and energizers are. You know, multiple questions blatantly around what are your things that naturally energize you. You know, really considering about actually what's good and right about you, what naturally energizes you. Tell us about a time. What's the proudest thing that happened in your life? You know, ask loads of those questions. When you're at your best, what is happening? What are you doing? What have you enjoyed most doing in your life? You know, a whole variety of questions are teasing that out, and it'll give you some clues around, right, this is what this person loves doing. Do we need that in our organization? You know, because that's where that individual is going to try and go most of the time.
Yeah. I think also the part of the problem is that a lot of people in organizations don't understand their culture, or they are, they're talking about maybe their ideal culture, not their actual culture. Yeah. And the clearer you get about what's going on and what we want to have go on, then the better you're going to be at hiring in the first place.
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. And it is about how often our leaders, you know, we've probably said this thousands of times, people have heard it, but how often are you actually just wandering around your organization, which I appreciate is difficult at times, but you do need to just be wandering around and just chatting to everybody, you know, and actually just tell us about your week. Tell us about what's going on for you. You know, how's your day going? What's happening? What are you working on? You need to do a lot of that to get a sense and a feel of like actually what people are saying to you.
Yes, does take time. But you're in the people business. And if you don't take time now, you're going to take a lot of time and resources later. So why not invest in people now, which means getting out of your office or whatever that is for you as a leader, whether you're the top in C-suite, you're a line manager, what does it mean for you authentically to really see and be invested in your people, to serve them and encourage them to be their best? And it is time up front, but once you get in the habit and you set those expectations, and people, when they see it and they don't think the principal is coming, but they think a colleague is coming who wants good for me, then what you're going to get, I mean, the benefits are just outrageous. They really are.
They are. They are. They so are. Yes. It's like it's that secret life. Find something that you love doing and find a way to have it for a living. And so you are absolutely want to take that principle of like, are in as many of the people pragmatically as possible in my organization, are they in that space or are they heading towards that space? And what is it else is it I can do to support them? Because yes, it helps with all of the numbers. Then you can sit around in all of your meetings about how's our numbers, stats, figures, you know, profits, shareholders. It has a positive impact upon those.
Absolutely. So Russell, when you look at all the different places that you worked and people you've worked with and for, can you tell us about a conflict that you had and how it resolved, what you did with it?
Thankfully, I've not had too many conflicts. I think one of the most difficult and challenging was, unfortunately, that I got bullied in one of the roles that I had. It was horrific. It was forceful. It was stressful. It was confusing. It was odd. It made you question yourself, all sorts of things like that. So it was thoroughly unpleasant. And, I'm grateful to an individual that one day I was doing my role and I'd gone to talk to them about something and they asked me the question. I can visualize it now, and it has an emotive response of, she just went, I just want to double check that you're really all right, Russell. Mm-hmm. And then at that moment, I had a look at the wall and go, no, I'm not. And she said, okay, so maybe you need to go and talk to this person here in the organization, which was a union person. And yeah, I am so grateful, because from that moment of this individual going, are you really all right? And me going, no. Mm-hmm. Then that was my route out of it. Essentially, that was my route out of it. So, the learning from it is probably would have asked for help at some stage, but I'm grateful that actually I asked for help sooner because somebody else came up to me and essentially gave me that poke and that prod, you know, so somebody checking in with us. And, what I learned about myself, I know that I'm a people pleaser. And that's like a real problem with that whole lifetime. It'll come up. It'll probably come up tomorrow or next week. You know, there's always, you know, most weeks there's like, oh yeah, that's because I was trying to please them, right? Yeah. But so that, I think that was the extra layer of confusing around it. So that the big learning is that I'm grateful that somebody checked in on me, and I've tried to make sure that I do that for everybody else, essentially. And when in another organization many years later, a member of my staff was being bullied by somebody senior, then I absolutely made sure that as my role as their line manager, I stood up to this person. Mm-hmm. It didn't go well in the fact that they utilized, I suppose, they utilized tears, you know, in that moment. But I, you know, I did what I think was, I knew was the right thing, essentially, because I was, somebody had helped me out. So I thought, yeah, this is happening to me and my staff. I will make sure that I go do something about it.
Yeah. With your example, it seems like there's at least two things that went well, is that somebody noticed you and said something.
Yeah.
But then there was a place for you to go. In yes. many organizations, they just don't, HR, at least in the States. Well, I know a lot of lovely HR professionals. Yeah. They don't really either have the training or the time, or it's not really in their role to help people deal with problems. When a lot of times when a problem comes to them, they are, how do I protect the organization? What does the lawyer want me to do? Because that's what they've been told. Organizations like having an ombuds, I don't know how familiar you are with the ombuds organization, or some sort yeah. of conflict resolution team that says, hey, these are the resources. This is what you can do. Because every organization says you don't have to be bullied or harassed. Yeah. But what's the real world help that what somebody reaches out for will actually help them and not compound it? Because a lot of times when people go to HR, then the person who makes the claim gets called out and they get harassed even further and damage is done.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Being in the field of learning development, you are the vast majority of time in the corporate world, you are under the HR banner. So yeah, you work with, you know, HR business partners and advisors, and you know, worked with loads of brilliant ones, and you do see that it is a bit of a double-edged sword for them of like, you know, I'm here to protect the organization. And so those that sort of say, I understand my role is here to protect the organization and the individual, that's a good starting point. Because you know that they're going to do their best to straddle a halfway house, you know? And yeah, you just hope that the individuals have got the value system to not go down that route of like calling somebody out and harassing them and going too far down the angle of I'm here to protect the organization above all else.
Yeah. And again, I love the HR professionals that I know, but I also know that just the way they're set up, at least currently in the States, it's not for the individual ultimately, which is not to their fault, but you know, what are individuals supposed to do? So the first thing is notice your colleagues, right? Notice the people that work for you, like yeah. you did when you noticed that somebody was being bullied, and then you act. And that's all we can do. We're not in charge of the future, but we are in charge of acting with courage from our conscience and our values. And yeah. then whatever happens, happens.
It is. And in that moment, it's down to this incredible word of confidence, one of the dimensions of being resilient. Mm-hmm. I wasn't feeling confident when I went and challenged the individual. You know, I had all those thoughts about, gosh, what are the consequences? What if it doesn't go well? Well, what if? But knew that I had to do it anyway. But that's given me the confidence years later or the rest of my career to do all sorts of things about making sure that they're contracting, essentially, guidelines, principles, ground rules, whatever you want to call them, about actually how we're going to treat each other, how we're going to behave towards each other. Let's talk about actually the behaviors that we expect and actually give feedback on it, you know, and be a role model around it and call it out, you know, in a professional sense, you know, mm-hmm. positively challenge as much as possible, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it gave me all of that driver to do that?
It's so amazing because I think a lot of times people think I don't have the courage or I don't have that capacity to challenge because I'm afraid. And it's like, well, that's not how courage works. You have the fear and you act anyway.
Yes.
And same thing with confidence. I don't have the confidence. Okay, well, how do you develop it? By going through a situation, you find out the world doesn't implode and you see how that went and maybe what you want to tinker with for the next time. But it's just amazing the kind of confidence that you get and how your courage develops. But it's not lack of pain and it's not lack of fear. If you're seeking those things, well, welcome to the human condition, right? You're going to have those things. It's what do you do next, right? How are you going to move forward and develop yourself?
Totally agree. Totally agree. Yes, there's and exactly what you just said. Yeah, I said, if you want to boil confidence down to its essence, just start with do something and reflect upon anything that went well about it and do it again based on those reflections. You know, even if like you did something and it was a disaster, you literally sort of say, well, I'm still here. It's right. Like that went well. It's like find anything that went well about it and do it again based upon those reflections. Yeah.
Yeah, those disasters, you know, we've all had them and you learn so much. I don't wish a disaster on anybody, especially an interpersonal disaster, but you do learn a lot, or there's the opportunity to learn a lot if you reflect and decide, you know, find the good. Sometimes the good is just surviving. It does build confidence if you're able to reflect and think, what am I going to do now?
So this is, so that's one of the many reasons. So when I talk about resilience, I define it as springing forward with learning. That's how I like people, when I work with clients, teams, organizations, I go, resilience is about springing forward with learning. So to be able to do that, you have to reflect.
Mm-hmm.
You have to pause. You have to reflect well, you know, strengths-based reflection, you know. You absolutely then do consider all the things that didn't go well about it, but you start with actually what went well. Not a fan of the term bounce back, because you can't go back. And I know it's a play on words in terms of spring forward, but that's what I really, you know, support my clients and work with colleagues around. You know, what does that mean to you? So from all of life's experiences, to be able to do the spring forward learning, you have to pause. You have to re-energize in those pauses, and you have to reflect and recuperate.
I love all of that, because in order to be a leader, we have to be reflective, right? Self-reflective, see how our actions are affecting others. But it's one thing to say, know thyself, right? Be self-reflective. Just do it. Well, okay, well, what does that mean? You know, how do I actually? And you do it in the everyday. You do it in the little. And it is a capacity that you can develop to, you don't just show up being self-reflective. It's the choices that you make about, as you just said, you laid it out. These are the ways in which you reflect and grow and see yourself in a different light. As you were talking about the beginning, the learning of the self, right? So
yes,
it's not only with topics, you know, like economics, it's with the self, you know, understanding the
totally.
Self. And we can go deeper into those circles of really understanding ourselves.
Yeah, no, we can. And just something that in reflections, something I've been saying a lot recently, allegedly we have 50,000 thoughts a day. And over half of them are negative. And 90% of our thoughts today are from yesterday. And lo and behold, half of those will be negative. Therefore, to be able to do the habit of reflecting, one does need to consciously, people that are listening now, actually get into the habit of what went well today, what was right, what was good. Start there, you know, expand that, spend time on that. And then shift into the what didn't go as well or as well as I would have liked. So, yeah, people sort of listening now, it's like if you're not doing it already, it needs to be this sort of conscious, habitual what went well. And, you know, start as well of create some form of like, you know, doodle or mind map or spider diagram or list of what your qualities are, what's good about you, what your strengths are. And it's like, how many of those have I utilized today? And that will help with actually getting some useful, practical, worthwhile reflection, in my opinion.
I agree. Positive psychology makes so much sense to me, where I think some people might think, oh, how am I ever going to get better if I only focus on the good things? And that's, of course, not what's going on. But we actually can get better at the things that we're good at if we recognize.
Yes.
And then it's all about focus. I'm focusing on the things I'm good at. And how can I tweak that? How can I turn the dial up? And the way that values or virtues and vices work, if you're focusing on one, the other one starts to recede. So if you focus on the negative, the good recedes. If you focus on the good, the negative recedes. And if our goal is to get better than we were the day before, how do we do that? So knowing this about human psychology, about the negative thoughts and how mean we are to ourselves, if we switch that in a healthy way, by taking
Yes.
stock of our failures, absolutely, our lacks, but that's
Totally.
not the first thing that we do, right? We do
No.
that better in light of who we act, the real truth about ourselves. Because the real truth is that most of us love our neighbors and our mamas, and we participate in community, and most of us, most of the time. And then there's the other, but we focus on the other.
Well, we do, and it's wonderful because it never ceases to amaze me that when I work with clients on an individual basis, we do the psychometric StrengthsScope because it's like how aware are your strengths, and they get their report and they look for like what are their high energizers and their low energizers, and their eyesight always goes to the sort of smaller score as they interpret it at the time. And it's not about the scores, but that's how they look at it. And they go, "Ah, oh, right. So my homework, my personal development plan is to get those smaller scores higher." And I go, "No, you can't. It's not possible. And no, that isn't your homework. Your homework is see these things here that you love doing, that float your boat, that you enjoy, that you're excited about. I want you to, your homework is to do more of them." And they're just like, "Well, that's just amazing. Right, okay." He says, "We are going to look at these things that you don't enjoy as much because, we will need to, but we'll look at them in a different way." And it's brilliant. It's lovely when, every time that happens, when people just go, "Oh, you want me to do more of the things that I love?" And I go, "Yes." It's like, "Well, that's just fantastic."
I love that so much. So, Russell, as you look into the future of work, what do you think needs to happen so that not only are people are treated with dignity and respect, but are they're encouraged to flourish and thrive?
So we've been talking about it. It really is continued. So, starts with self-awareness around really, do you really know what your natural energizers are? Think about this question about, what's two or three times when you felt really proud in your life and what did you do? Because that'll be have something to do with your strengths. And then anybody and everybody that is a line manager, so from chairman to CEO all the way down, anybody's whose holidays that you sign off, you're a line manager, essentially. So any of those people that are listening now, it's like, how aware are you of your people's strengths? If it's like, if I gave you 5 minutes to think about it and come back and say, right, I've got Bob, Mary, Fred, Asif, Akbar, tell us their strengths. Could you do that? And if they're like, no, I haven't got a clue, you go, right, there's a massive opportunity for you there. So, and then your role as a line manager is to harness those. And as a result of that, people will flourish, people will thrive, people will feel resilient because playing to your strengths builds natural resilience and natural confidence. And confidence is one of the dimensions of being resilient. So it's the double whammy. That's how you'll crack it. You absolutely will crack that to start with. Take this, natural energizer strengths-based approach. And all of those things about, but what about the mistakes? But what about is going. Absolutely, that is part of a strengths-based approach. But here and now, just consider everybody that's listening, how aware are you of your own strengths? And all those people that report into you, how aware of you are those? And are you having conversations with them to harness those strengths week by week?
I love that. Excellent. Well, Russell, thank you so much for your time. It's been a delight talking with you today.
Likewise. Thank you, Mary. Really loved it. Thank you.
Thank you, Russell. What a fun conversation. Resiliency. My word. I mean, that's the name of the game, because whatever you're doing at work right now, it is going to change. And you're like, but Mary, I'm in the middle of a change right now. Yes, you'll get through that change and something else will come along, or something else will come up in the culture. So developing your resiliency capacity now, no matter what's going on, will help you into the future. And your future self will thank you so much for doing it. So Russell, thank you for dedicating your work to helping people become resilient. Conflict Managed is produced by third-party workplace conflict restoration services and hosted by me, Mary Brown. You can find us online at 3pconflictrestoration.com. Come back. We have new episodes every Tuesday. If there's someone you would like to see or hear on Conflict Managed, please reach out to us. You can email us at 3pconflictrestoration@gmail.com. If you haven't had a chance to look at my new book, How to Be Unprofessional at Work, Tips to Ensure Failure, it's 80 tips of what not to do at work and starts a conversation about how to have a healthy work environment. It's available on Amazon. Our music is courtesy of Dove Pilot. And remember, conflict is normal and to be expected. Let's deal with it. Until next time, take care.